I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of October. The U.S. Conference of Mayors released a study late in August showing that the United States has regained the 8.7 million jobs lost in the recession, but the average wage has dropped 23%. The report also found a widening income gap between the rich and poor. Our guest this hour, David K. Johnson, who's been with us many times before and is a top-notch economist, says that past recoveries were faster and produced broad prosperity, but this recovery, which began in July of 2009, has showered gains on the few at the top, while a vast majority has lost ground despite a growing economy. The 16,000 households at the very, very top, the 1% of the 1%, captured one-third of all reported income gains in 2012, compared with 2009, whereas the bottom 90% suffered a loss in income. David K. Johnson is our guest this hour. He has been with us, as I said, many times before. He's an investigative journalist and author. His specialty is economics and tax issues. He won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize while being a reporter for the New York Times. And he has done reporting for so many different newspapers. His career has been long and a lot of breadth. He started at the San Jose Mercury News. He's worked for the LA Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Times. He's written a number of books. His latest is Divided: The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And he is also author of Free Lunch: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, and a number of other books as well. David is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. And here is how you reach us: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter if you'd like to reach us there, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, David. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, delighted to be here.
Yeah. Glad to have you here. You wrote that the average real hourly wage is now, and this is an astounding figure, David, 6% smaller than in 1972 and 1973. We're making a lot less money.
We are. Part of the reason for that is so much of total compensation, that's how your boss looks at it, he looks at the total cost, is going to health care. Our healthcare system spends more than 40% of all the healthcare spending in the world, and it's so expensive that in the year 2010, that's the latest year we have global data, if we had had the French healthcare system, which is widely regarded as the best in the world, we would have had universal coverage of healthcare, virtually no out-of-pocket expenses for people, and it would have saved so much money, we could have had a one-year holiday on the federal income tax.
Why is it so hard for us to move in that direction? It's hard to imagine that's going to happen anytime soon in this country, if ever.
Well, I find this very difficult to understand. I mean, there was a time in the 70s, for example, when Lee Iacocca, who was at the time the head of Chrysler, and other big industrialists were saying we should have universal health care because they wanted to get it off their books and onto the books of society. And for small business owners, and I've been a small business owner, it's a terrible headache to deal with health insurance. Part of the reason, frankly, is racism. And I'm sure some people are not happy to hear me say that, but when I have brought this up before, I find I get pummeled with emails and references on the internet that I'm race baiting and that's just nonsense, and then language that suggests that this idea that you don't want to do anything for somebody who isn't like you is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's a second problem, that the health insurance industry has put so much money into politics. It is a totally superfluous industry. There's no need for it. And it leads to very high costs. And, of course, the point of insurance is to not pay claims if you can avoid them. And insurance companies go to great lengths to try and discourage people from collecting paperwork, all the annoyances that we put up with that make our economy less efficient. It's a big make-work program where we have all sorts of people moving paperwork around that makes no sense. And we don't have the best health care in the world. In fact, our system is so awful that every day in America, 15 babies die who would live had they been born in Cuba, of all places. Cuba.
So what would be our economic advantage just to the average person if we did have a completely different healthcare system? How much more money would we have in our pockets?
Well, if we'd had the French healthcare system, mm-hmm. one of the most expensive in the world, it would mean that we'd have about 6 percentage points of our economy available to do other things. And if we were using that money in other ways, it could be more productive. We could be investing more in basic research, in education, in fixing up and improving our infrastructure, which is falling apart. Employers would be able to hire more people because this is off of their backs. Now, the downside would be there are a whole lot of people that would be thrown out of work because their jobs are basically pushing paper, but efficiency is a very important element in economics. I think there's also a fundamental moral issue. I've known a whole group of people who have died. When I hear some member of Congress, including one who's a physician from Georgia, Dr. Paul Brown, say, well, you know, we have universal health care. Anybody can go to the emergency room. Not if you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what emergency rooms treat. Not if you have some chronic illness. If you get cancer, we'll treat you at taxpayer expense if you don't have health care at the point at which you become disabled. And that's basically the point at which you are most likely to die rather than be cured.
Well, and then you look at the story that's everywhere, the Ebola worldwide problem, and think about the amount of money that really needs to go into some fairly basic research right now. To help the people in Africa and ultimately people all over the world who will be infected
right.
with this virus.
Well, we've cut the budget of the Centers for Disease Control by, I believe it's a little under $600 million.
Mm.
And now we're not equipped to deal with this. And, you know, pathogens like Ebola, they don't have any politics. They don't have any religion. All they have is a simple, basic need. To grow and live, and their growth and living means people die, and we should be putting more effort into this. Ebola happens to be the worst thing we know about at the moment, but we can have new kinds of flu that arise
right.
and other changes because viruses and bacteria are evolving all the time, and if we're not keeping up with them with such a large population in the world, we're going to have terrible pandemics in the future. But that requires thinking about government not as something that drains the economy, but government as something that can make the economy more efficient and effective and create the basic public structure on which private wealth and individual liberty are built.
All right. Well, I didn't imagine we were going to start the conversation there, but it's worthwhile. Let's go back to this report, the U.S. Conference
yes.
of Mayors report. U.S. regained 8.7 million jobs lost in the recession, but the average wage dropped 23%. So what are those jobs?
Well, what's happened coming out of this recession is we're not getting back a lot of the quality jobs that we had. I mean, this is a problem that's been going on for a long time before the recession. But there's huge gains in productivity. And normally those are divided between management and labor. The way economists measure it is returns to labor and returns to capital. And the official data show that returns to capital have been falling and falling and falling and falling, and labor have been falling and falling and falling, and returns to capital have just been going through the roof. And so now we end up with businesses that have more money in profits that they've collected than they can invest to expand their business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an imbalance that's going on. We'll get the new wage data Thursday or Friday or early next week. On 2013, but what the data basically show is that since 1998, the median wage, half of Americans make more, half make less, has been unchanged at a little over $500 a week. It hasn't grown. And that's at the core of our problem, is people, we don't have enough what's called aggregate demand, the total capacity of people to buy goods and services. My column at Al Jazeera America today, Kathleen, is about Walmart. Walmart is, its finances are deteriorating. Its debt is going up. Its return on assets is going down. And the reason is Walmart's customer base is the bottom half of the American economy, and people there don't have the money to spend. And I point out that if Walmart made two simple changes in its way it pays its executives, one of them particularly, then they would be aligned with the interests of low-income workers. And that is set the bonuses of Walmart executives on increases in same-store sales.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, all of a sudden, Walmart's senior executives are going to be out in the forefront saying, we need a higher minimum wage, we need to be paying people better, we need to have full employment. Instead, they get measured by something called operating profit, and that basically rewards them for holding down the wages of Walmart workers, since they're the biggest employer in the country, 1.4 million workers. When they do that, it encourages and promotes other employers to do the same thing.
Hmm. What do you make of all these movements? And evidently it will be on the ballot in some states or cities this midterm election season. Seattle, New York City now, Los Angeles, many other cities raising the minimum wage. Will that spark the economy in those places? And do you see this as a movement that's just starting to take hold?
Well, this is, unfortunately, when you have intransigence at the top, and by that I mean Congress, this is how social change comes about in America. One of the canards that the data don't support is that if you raise the minimum wage, there'll be fewer jobs. In fact, there's a very good study of counties in two states, you know, bordering each other, where one state raised the minimum wage and the other didn't. And there's no measurable effect, no loss of jobs. In San Jose, California, they raise the minimum wage for restaurant workers. There's no evidence that people are driving to the suburbs in order to avoid paying another dime on their $30 or $50 dinner. And so these measures, I think, will help improve the lives of people. They will reduce the amount of welfare that we have to spend. You know, Walmart collects, through its workers, $6.8 billion a year in welfare subsidies, government-financed health care, food stamps, and other benefits because the workers don't make enough money to live on their own. And we should be thinking about why in the world would we want such an inefficient system? Why would we want to do that? Why would we want to say you work full-time, but you don't make enough money to eat? I was at a conference this morning where I live in Rochester, New York, on poverty in Rochester. Rochester was the combined Silicon Valley and Seattle of the 19th century. It was incredibly wealthy. And the person who spoke ahead of me told about a boy who was asked, all the children in class were asked to draw a picture of them having dinner last night. And the teacher said, well, you know, why is your paper blank? He says, just what did you have for dinner last night? And he said, nothing.
Hmm.
And well, no, just put down what you had. And finally, the boy said, nothing. It wasn't my turn to eat last night.
Oh, my.
And we have programs all over the country where we're sending food home with children on weekends because people don't have enough to eat. This is awful, and it's not necessary.
So tell me, put in the equation here, those people, when you look at the total national increase in income in 2012 over 2009, you write about this astonishing one-third went to just 16,000 households. How could that be? Who are those households? Who's making all of that money? And if there are people who are going to bed because they haven't had a chance to eat because it wasn't their turn, how can we exist in a society that doesn't allow those people to have dinner when you have an enormous amount of money going to really 16,000 households? Seriously?
Yeah, 16, yes. The difference, this is about government policy. The reason that we have falling incomes for most Americans, the reason we're making less per hour now than we were back in the early 1970s, is tied up with a bunch of issues, including the loss of unions, and all of our major competitors have unions. I mean, in Germany, executives have unions. In Japan, Unions are required under the Constitution that was written by General Douglas MacArthur's staff. They all have unions, but we've gotten rid of them in America, and surprise, surprise, workers now don't have bargaining power, so their wages have been falling. The people at the top who garnered the top 1% of Americans, that's 1.5 million households, 3.1 million people, they got 95 cents out of every dollar of income growth from 2009, when the Great Recession officially ended, to 2012. And a third of that total amount went to the 1% of the 1%. That's those 16,000 households. And that's because of the way our economy's rules are set up. The books that you mentioned that I've written, I've been showing where the government has all these stealth policies that few people know about. You can dig them out of the public record, but nobody announces this, that basically take money from everybody listening to this show and put it in the pocket of Warren Buffett. And I'll give you a good example of why he's doing so well and you're not. Warren Buffett's company, it doesn't pay taxes. It gets from the government zero interest loans under the tax system. Buffett himself writes about this.
Right.
Right now, his company, Berkshire Hathaway, has a $57 billion, billion with a B, $57 billion zero interest loan from the government. That is, taxes that it will have to pay in the future on profits it earned in the past. Just imagine how well off you'd be if every week, instead of paying taxes, the government gave you your tax money and said, well, go invest it, and 30 years from now you can pay us back with no interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stock markets come back. Remember, under Obama, the stock market has more than doubled. So people in the 1% of the 1% get a great deal of their income from capital gains, and they've done very well. They've been able to sell their stocks and buy new ones at enormous markups. Whereas the 90% of Americans whose income is down about 2%, so basically they're getting 51 weeks pay for 52 weeks of work, the bottom 90% of Americans, they don't have unions. They haven't been getting general pay increases. They have had, as Walmart announced it's doing last week, they've been forced to divert more of their cash earnings to health insurance. Because the company is not making as big a profit as it wants because its customers don't have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a vicious cycle. We can turn into a virtuous cycle very easily, but we have to understand what's going on if we want to improve our economy.
David K. Johnston is our guest this hour, and we're going to be welcoming phone calls for him. David has been for a long time now an investigative journalist and author. He won a Pulitzer in 2001 while with the New York Times. He now writes a column for Al Jazeera America. He's a prolific author. His most recent book is Divided: The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He's also a distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University at the College of Law and Whitman School of Management, and has written many other books and written for a number of prominent newspapers all over the country. We're looking generally at the U.S. economy, but the starting point for our conversation was the U.S. Conference of Mayors releasing their report recently showing the U.S. has regained 8.7 million jobs lost in the recession, but the average wage has dropped 23%. So even though the jobs are there, nobody's feeling very great about the amount of money they are making, because the money isn't going to the average worker. What do you think about all of this? And David, of course, started the conversation with the extraordinarily high cost of health care in this country, and that also being part of the problem with our economy. Here is our phone number. Our lines get busy when he is with us, so call in as early as you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for David K. Johnston. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we start with Virginia in Rock County. Hi, Virginia.
Hello. I want to say, before I get to my issue, I want to thank this man for speaking for the poor and working class. No one's doing it, and no one's doing it as well as I've heard this morning. But I have an issue when he was talking about funding for Ebola research and how we're not doing enough. And at the same time, he can talk about the poor in this country. We are spending enough money on research, on medical research. The thing is, it's going to foolish maternal deprivation studies at the universities all over this country. Millions and millions of federal dollars are going to universities for ridiculous, duplicative animal research that doesn't profit anybody or anything. It's not going to sell research. It's not going to prevention of disease. It's a matter of priorities and who is making the decisions.
David.
Well, first of all, thank you, Virginia. That's very kind of you. There are a lot of other people who are working on issues about this besides me. On the issue of research, we're only funding about 10% of the top-rated medical research grants. And I, frankly, and I know a lot of people who do medical research, haven't heard anything like what Virginia understands. I mean, we've had people who say, why are we studying fruit flies? Well, because they're one of the most efficient, effective way to study certain kinds of things because they reproduce so quickly in their genome and their style allows us to do all sorts of things we would be much more expensive to do otherwise. To get funded for a medical research project, you've got to show that you're going to really break new ground, or you are going to show us something useful or and sometimes commercially productive. But I don't think we're spending anywhere near enough on medical research. We have large numbers of people who are not employed. We have scientists who have left the United States to go to India and China and Singapore and other places because they can get funding there and we can't. And you know what happens when the breakthroughs are made in those countries? The profits will flow to those countries, not here. So I would disagree with Virginia. I don't think we're spending nearly enough. And by the way, the head of the CDC yesterday came out and said, you know, we would have had an Ebola virus vaccine by now, but for the cuts to our budget.
Thank you very much, Virginia, for your call. Let's go to Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I've heard the gentleman before and didn't get a chance to really call in. My question is always, what is the solution? You know, we go to federal government for solutions, and in my opinion, they're all Republicrats. They're both in the same party. They're both going to take care of the rich. That's where they get their money from for their campaigns. That's who their friends are. And so whether it's Republicans or Democrats, I don't see this changing. And the only way that's going to change is when the public, the people that are only making minimum wage, rise up and demand a change. And, you know, we had that twice already, and it just keeps on being demonized. First, there was the Tea Party rebellion at the convention in Minneapolis, and then later there was the March on Wall Street. And every time something like this comes up, the powers that are just demonize it so that no one think they're a bunch of hotheads. But unless we get a change, and it's not going to be from either of those parties, it's going to stay the way it is. The people, as long as the workers are complacent and they don't, they'll complain, but they won't do anything about it, it's not going to change.
David.
Ralph raised a very interesting point and an important one, but, you know, that's always been the history in America. My research assistants at the law school last year were digging into the history of corporations in colonial America, and one of the things they turned up and I was fascinated by was the founding fathers of this country writing in newspapers and elsewhere that people were complacent and they couldn't get them to understand that it was necessary to put their effort into getting free from the British. The abolition movement in this country to get rid of slavery, its leaders for years were complaining, you know, we can't get people to act. And we're seeing in the minimum wage movement, I think, a good example of that, and the Walmart, anti-Walmart movement, which shouldn't demonize Walmart. It should try to get Walmart to change its behavior. We're seeing, in fact, grassroots efforts where people are saying this is wrong and we need to do something about it. But I agree with Ralph that the problem at the top is that both Republicans and Democrats draw from the same narrow well of money. And I think that reforming campaign finance and ending this gerrymandering of districts, to which right now is being used by the Republicans to corral Democrats, but it could turn around. Democrats could turn around and do the same thing to Republicans if we don't change the rules in the future. We need to have real reform of those two issues, campaign finance and how congressional districts are set up.
You know, I was really struck, and you say we're going to get new numbers on 2013 soon, but you wrote that more than half of U.S. workers, 53% in the year 2012, make $30,000 a year or less. That's a huge number of Americans, and I think that many of our callers are making the point that there isn't a politician. There are a few, but it isn't rhetoric that's directed at making their lives easier, because it's not easy to live, particularly in many places in this country, on $30,000 a year.
Right.
And yet,
even if you have two incomes, that's $60,000.
Right.
You're not doing screamingly well. The Divided, which I edited and has all the heavy hitters in it, giving chapters so you can piece by piece see all the different aspects of inequality. The opening story I tell is of calling the Bush White House in January of 2001, right after the election, or maybe it was February, and I wanted comment from them on the new official government income data that had come out. And the Deputy White House Press Secretary, Claire Buchan, kept saying, where are you getting these numbers, you know, and questioning their legitimacy. And I finally stopped. I said, Claire, what do you think is the median income reported on tax returns? Half of Americans say they make less than so much and half make more. And she goes, $250,000.
Oh, my gosh. Did she really?
It was right. It was $28,000. And. But if you live in that world where everybody you see is rich, the people who come to the White House arrive in private jets. You go to fundraisers where people spend right. $5,000 just to be in the room with the president or the presidential candidate. Of course you have a distorted view of this. And remember that now the top television journalists, Katie Couric, when she was the anchor for the CBS Evening News, her annual salary was greater than the combined budgets of the NPR shows All Things Considered and Morning Edition.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So you get a very – and even, you know, I mean, journalists up until very recently, because they had unions, were paid better than average wages. When I was 19 years old and got hired as a staff writer at the San Jose Mercury – I was in the top 10% of all wage earners.
Were you really?
I went from being on minimum wage, working 80 hours a week at four different jobs on a Friday, to being in the top 10% of wage earners on a Monday. I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money. I made in today's dollars something on the order of $50,000. But it was a dramatic change. And so newsrooms, which when I started out were full of blue-collar intellectuals, a lot of people hadn't gone to college. Now newsrooms are full of people who have gone to the most elite universities in many cases, especially at the big papers. They've come from very well-to-do homes. There are plenty of journalists I worked with at the New York Times whose parents were surgeons and business owners and in some cases billionaires and were themselves worth tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars. And so they're view of the world, perfectly reasonably from how they were brought up, is, gee, the world seems pretty just to me. And that permeates through our society.
Yeah. Marion Boscobel, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, I had heard over the past year or so that the very wealthy had planned on having some kind of a big meeting over in Europe, like Switzerland or something. Have you heard of anything like that? Does that show, was that just more smoke and mirrors, or does it show that they are concerned?
Well, Mary, every year there is a meeting at Davos, Switzerland, sometimes called the Billionaires' Ball. It's technically known as the World Economic Forum, and thousands of journalists go there to cover it. It is essentially run by those billionaires who have something of a social conscience. Remember that if you're one of the Waltons, for example, and they're all multi-billionaires, your fortune is tied to the well-being of people in the bottom half. If your fortune comes from the L'Oreal cosmetics company in France, for example, if people can't afford to buy your cosmetics, you're not going to make a lot of money. And so the more thoughtful billionaires, the ones whose view is we can create more wealth, we can build a better society, go to Davos, and they discuss the issues about how do we improve the world economy, because the better the world economy gets, the better off the people at the top get.
Here's an email from Rebecca. My husband is a high school teacher. This fall, our insurance premium is over $32,000 per family with a $7,000 deductible. As taxpayers and as consumers of this product, we're outraged. One of the reasons for the high price is the district hired an insurance negotiator who gets paid. His company gets paid. The insurance company they find for us gets paid, and the provider gets paid. That's four layers of profit before a patient gets served.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a typo or a mistake in Rebecca's email, Kathleen. My wife is the CEO of a very big, successful nonprofit that she built up from nothing to over $300 million. And we get an executive health care plan, and it only costs about $15,000 a year. But there's no question that this is an incredibly inefficient system. The little business that I founded and my son has since retired me from, I spent inordinate numbers of hours trying to figure out how to get the only full-time employees, my two sons, health care. When I mentioned this to friends of mine who own businesses, who are very wealthy, some of them rich enough to own their own airplanes, you know, they go, well, I just hire a broker. Mm-hmm. And I go, well, yeah, you're big enough to hire a broker. You know, you've got hundreds or thousands of workers. But small business people don't do that. And school districts, they don't employ armies of people to do that. Their job is to educate. That's one of the reasons we should be changing our health care system and recognize that the Affordable Care Act is a big improvement, because people with pre-existing conditions can now get health care, and young people still getting an education can stay on their parents' plan until they're 26. But the efficient way to do this is to go to, and there are various ways of doing it, to do what the rest of the modern world has done, go to a single-payer plan, and then make sure that people organize to make sure there's enough capital invested in it so we get quality care.
Thanks for your email. Let's go to Louise in Madison. Hi, Louise.
Hi there. I was wondering if your guests had any insight as to why those on the lower economic rungs vote Republican. My friends and I have this discussion a lot, and we feel like they're voting against their own self-interest. And why those folks think big business is good and government is bad. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Louise, that's a terrific issue. And they do it for the same reason that when I was a teenager in the 60s, young men bought Brill Cream. Because advertising told you, you know, a little grease in your hair and the girls will be all over you. It's utter nonsense. But, you know, look at the ads on TV. To go back to my favorite example of this, in the 80s, they had these ads about with a bunch of guys in a college dorm, and they popped open some kind of beer, and the Swedish bikini team shows up. You know what? It sold a lot of beer.
Right.
And the people at the top who want to make it easier for themselves, they have hired very smart people to mislead people. And finally, I'll give you the example of my brother. My brother is a manual laborer who, you know, the reason people could get to work was he was the guy in the culvert in the rainstorm helping getting the tree out of the culvert so the water would flow. And he's now disabled. He's in his 60s. Eric said to me one day, well, you know, if I hated gays, if I cared about God or if I were into guns, then I'd vote for the Republicans. And besides, what have the Democrats done for me? And I think that if the Democrats would behave like Democrats, you'd see a big change. Polls show the country is vastly more progressive. 73% of Republicans want to increase Social Security benefits. 3 out of 4 Republicans think Social Security benefits should be larger. The leaders of their party want to dismantle Social Security. There's a huge disconnect, but the reason it hasn't been put together is lack of leaders to do it and misleading what I call ideological marketing that sells bad ideas just like bad things like Brill Cream got sold to people.
And you make a point in one of your columns, David, that the minimum wage hike was the first in a decade in 2000, initiated by President George W. Bush with the aid of quite a few Republicans. That would never happen today.
It is astonishing. This is 2007. President Bush signed a three-part increase in the minimum wage, 70 cents a year for 3 years in a row. It's the reason that the American workers are making $20,000 a year. That's about 38% of all American workers, actually saw a little increase in 2012 compared to 2000. The group above them, $20,000 to $40,000, their wages fell. And I think all but 4 Senate Republicans and 82 House Republicans voted to raise the minimum wage. And many of those Republicans are now going and saying, "Wow, we have to eliminate the minimum wage. It's a horrible thing. It's terrible." Really? I mean, if take that to its logical conclusion. What if we had no minimum wage at all and a whole lot of wealthy kids who were willing to work for nothing? By the way, that's called the internship program.
Yeah, that's just what I was thinking.
The fact is that slavery created enormous fortunes, a huge part of the wealth of this country. And there are a lot of economists, economic historians have been going back now through the records and showing this. Well, let's carry it to its logical extreme. We don't have to have the slavery of the peculiar institution of the America slavery. We can have the slavery of the ancient world, and people in debt can simply sell themselves and exchange their debt for going to work for a big company as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, everybody else in the modern world has minimum standards, and they're higher than ours. When you go to Western Europe, not only are the buildings not falling apart and the roads not falling apart, but you aren't besieged by people who are basically beggars.
And then you have an inside track to a job, and you're not allowing all the people who have to work at minimum wage jobs to pay for their education. It's the rich people who can afford to do those internships, and then they'll get the job.
Right.
So it's another layer of inequality.
And scholarships, just Kathleen, the data show that more and more scholarships are going to kids who come from the top quartile, the top quarter of households in America. No. They should be going to smart, ambitious kids in the bottom quartile.
David K. Johnston is our guest. We're welcoming phone calls. We're talking about the state of the U.S. economy, why it is feeling that we're not doing very well, even though the U.S. gained back the jobs that it lost during the recession. What's happened is that the average wage has dropped 23%, and David's analyzing all of this for us. Thanks, Louise, for your call. We have a couple lines open. They've been busy. If you'd like to call right now, that's a good idea. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston is with us this hour talking about the economy and why we don't feel as though we're doing very well. 800-486-8655. Here's a good eye-opening sentence, and you wrote a column on this. Americans have lost out on $6.6 trillion. Explain what you mean, David.
Well, starting in 1998, when he was running for president, then-Governor George Bush said that if his tax cut plan was enacted, we would all be better off. And in October of 2000, you may remember that the Bush campaign, began running ads talking about the coming Al Gore recession. And they were talking about maybe we're already in the Al Gore recession, they just haven't announced it yet. So I called up the Bush campaign. I was at the New York Times then, and said, since you think we're going to a recession, you want to hedge your bet at all about everybody will be better off? I mean, if we go into a recession, people might be worse off for a year or two, and you've made this unqualified promise. This was taken as a very hostile question, so much so that I gave the number of the executive editor of the New York Times to the person I was talking to. And then finally I was told there are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Elect President Bush, put his tax plan into place, and we will be better off than we are today. And he said, when's your story running? And I said, oh, in about 10 years, because we'd have the data. So we now, the Bush tax cuts were in effect for a total of 12 years. They're mostly still in effect, but they were fully in effect for 12 years. So I went into the official data and computed the average income and adjusted it for inflation and for the number of taxpayers. And when you add it up, it turns out we have made $6.6 trillion less money from 2001 through 2012 than we were making in the year 2000. And here's how much money that is. Assuming it was fully taxed for Social Security and Medicare and taxed at the average rate of income taxes, after paying those taxes, there would be enough money to pay off every car loan in America, every credit card debt in America, every student loan in America, and every taxpayer would still have almost $18,000 cash that they could save or spend. This has been a terrible toll on the American economy. And the simple reality is the Bush tax cuts did not work. They did not produce their promised results. I didn't set the standard here, and I didn't even hold President Bush to his own standard. I held him to a lower standard. Not would we be better off than 2000, just as well off. And by the way, I raised the question back then, well, what about unexpected things that happen? You know, things presidents have no control over. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about this. So don't think, oh, well, there was the Iraq War, a war sold on lies that wasn't necessary, or there was 9/11, which had no economic consequence. It's not inconsequential economically. It just didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is we starved the public sector. Private wealth is built on a foundation of commonwealth. And we have been starving the public sector. It's the equivalent of building a skyscraper on a foundation that you are undermining.
Hmm. And along those lines, an email from Rich in Rhinelander who says there's sort of a grandiosity operating in American society. The market knows. The market adjusts. The market takes care of us all. The market is a magical system that will solve all social issues. He says his point is there's sort of a market force idolatry going on in our country. We have forgotten the concept of the common good, provide for the common general welfare, or of, by, and for the people.
And it also matters a lot, the rules of markets. My column in Al Jazeera America last week, and it's about the fifth I've done this year for them, is about how something called regulatory capture. And it's where the places where, like utilities, you don't have a market, so the government has to be a proxy. And it's supposed to balance the interests of the customers with the balance of with the interests of the owners. And instead, we're finding that these agencies are operating totally on behalf of the companies. In fact, there's a criminal investigation going on now in California where the office of the president of the Public Utilities Commission, the former president of the second biggest utility in the state for 12 years has been the president, was working hand in glove to pick the judge who was going to hear a rate increase case. Mm. I mean, it's corrupt. There's no other way to describe it. So market rules also matter.
Jim in St. Croix Falls. Hi.
Hi. I have an idea that I'd like to present to you that's a little contrary to what most people think, but I believe that the redistribution of wealth to the very top was and is intentional. And I have a little bitty story to illustrate that.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure. Tell us the little bitty story.
After the 1976 RNC in Kansas City, my father-in-law and I were sitting on a bluff high over Enders Reservoir in Nebraska, and he had gone to that convention as a delegate committed to Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why in the world? Well, we were drinking scotch, and he got pretty loose. And so I said, why in the world would you want to see Ronald Reagan be president? And he said, Jim, look out there at that reservoir. There's probably 30 or 40 boats out there. When I was your age, there'd just be two or three of us. He said, it's just not supposed to be that way. I said, well, how are you going to change it? He said, well, we're going to get rid of unions. And I said, well, how are you going to do that? And he said, you just watch. And, of course, Reagan went on to win the next election. He lost that nomination, but he won the next one. And he provoked, and then he locked out the
air traffic controllers. Yeah,
control. Jim, you're quite right about that. In fact, there have been people, I didn't do this, but other people, who simply tracked the percentage of private sector workers who belong to unions, the percentage, with wages. And what they show is a very clear relationship. When about 37% of private sector workers belong to unions, that was 1973, about 80% of workers benefited. Some companies paid premium wages to keep unions out, not because of the wages, because they didn't want the union work rules primarily. And by doing that, they got the benefit of being able to pick the cream of the crop to work for them. But as unions were decimated, and clearly that was part of Reagan's agenda before he came into office, workers lost bargaining power. And we don't have going back to the previous item, Rich, we don't have a labor market anymore. We have a one-sided market, and all the power is with the employers.
We're not seeing any kind of resurgence. There are a few more unions developing among hotel workers and some of those workers. But do you see it within the realm of possibility that there would be a resurgence of unions in this country, David?
Well, here's the issue, Kathleen. It's the rules on union organizing that have been put in place that make it virtually impossible to organize a union. Employers who illegally fire the leaders of a union organizing drive can end up paying no damages at all, because if the leader of the drive is making $15 an hour, they fire that person and she then gets another job for $15.25 an hour. The position of the federal government is no harm was done, and they don't have to pay anything. And so this is this thing that I spend a lot of my effort with, is digging out these rules, these complicated, mind-numbing rules. And the fundamental story there is people who make money off government policy have gone in and seen to it that the rules are all rewritten to stack the deck on their side. It's just as simple as that. And we need to have a thoroughgoing cleaning of the rules. We can get back unions when we decide politically we're going to make it possible to have unions again. And we need to really kill this argument that unions destroy jobs. It's not true. If it were true, then all of our economic competitors would be in terrible trouble. And instead, they don't have the huge welfare burdens we do because people earn reasonable amounts of money.
David, thank you very much. And perhaps somebody from NPR, as a result of this conversation, will go to Katie Couric and ask her for a lot of money.
I hope so.
She could fund us, right, for a long time. Thanks, yeah. David, as always. Great hour. David K. Johnston, our pleasure. David is writing a column now for Al Jazeera America. He's distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University. He's a longtime investigative journalist and author, specializing in economics and tax issues, won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize while he was with the New York Times. He's worked at newspapers all over the country. And his most recent book, we interviewed him on this a while back, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. He says that Americans in inflation-adjusted terms are back to the average income of 1966. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, with help from Scott Myers. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we will go back to the Founding Fathers, to the Revolutionary Times, with the author of Gentlemen Scientists and Revolutionaries, The Founding Fathers in the Age of Enlightenment.